Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we broadcast today. We pay our respect to the elders of all of the lands on which we meet across Australia.
Welcome, welcome to Freedom of Species. We are here on a sunny afternoon with myself, Meg, and the star of the show, Betty, who is going to bring us a fantastic show today. She's done a lot of research on this show, and I'm actually really interested to see how this has all panned out, because this is a big show that you've been planning for quite some time and doing a bit of research on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's not hype it up too much, but
all right. No
but
worries.
Yeah, I've been interested in this topic for a while. Yeah, okay. So we're talking today about the history of the Australian wool industry, a vegan's history, if you will.
So looking at it from a different perspective than what might a historian or somebody who's part of the industry, etc., that it just brings a different perspective and maybe brings up some things that perhaps they wouldn't want us to see and, you know, and connect some dots which might not really be connected, you know, previously. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're obviously coming at this from a perspective, like a vegan perspective and a perspective that's against colonial expansion. And so I've read and listened to a lot of different histories about the Australian wool industry, but I don't really see any which are against the industry as a whole. And so I guess that's what I'm trying to do here, kind of fill that gap.
Mm. So basically coming from an animal advocate's perspective on an industry that has had a huge impact on the Australian economy, on colonialism, etc. But I don't want to tell the story for you because I don't know it as well as you do. Why don't we launch into it?
Yeah. So I was just going to say, way back in January, I did this show with Trev for Freedom of Species that was called Human Hair and Sheep's Wool, A Tale of Two Textiles. And originally that was going to be like a part one, but, you know, I got busy writing my honours thesis. So here we are 6 months later. You don't have to listen to part one for today's show to make sense, but you can always look into our podcast archive on 3cr.org.au/freedom of species or on any podcast platform.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So today's show, it's more going to focus about like the history and geopolitics which created the Australian wool industry. So actually, Meg, you sent something to the Freedom of Species group chat the other day.
Yes.
New literature just dropped on this topic. So there's a book that just came out.
A little timely.
Yeah. There's a book that's only just come out. It's called Fleeced, Unraveling the History of Wool and War by Trish Fitzsimmons and Madeline Shaw. And I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I only just heard about it. But I managed to find a talk online that the authors did just last month at their book launch at the National Library of Australia. And yeah, they talk about a lot of interesting things. They talk about, yeah, so their book is about wool and war. And one point they made that I'm interested to research more about this is they were saying that possibly World War I may have not been able to happen if the Australian wool industry hadn't been already built up to such a large scale.
What? That is, wow. Do you know any more information about that?
That's
really interesting.
But it's just like they needed so much wool for this cold weather warfare.
Yeah.
Everybody's uniforms needed.
The uniforms were made of wool.
They were made of wool. And at that time period, they didn't really have any alternative. I think there were materials that got invented during that time, such as rayon, but it really wasn't like a good alternative.
There was no mass production yet of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and it just wasn't as good as wool. Like, it wasn't as durable. So, yeah, the Australian wool industry was really part of what kind of enabled that war. And also people got really rich off of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But that'll be sort of for a future episode. Today, I'm more going to be focusing on, like, the real early days of the Australian wool industry and kind of the period leading up to that. So, something I personally wanted to do when I joined the Freedom of Species team just over a year ago now was to raise conversations about animal exploitation as a geopolitical issue.
Yeah.
So we see conflicts happening around the world about who gets control of the land. We all know that agriculture takes up a lot of space. And of course, we need agriculture for food and materials. But did you know that 77% of the agricultural land on this planet is dedicated to animal agriculture? And that includes not just the grazing land, but the crops that are grown specifically as feed for agricultural animals. In fact, 40% of the world's crop calories are used as animal feed. And if we were to instead use these cereals for direct human consumption, we could feed an extra 3.5 billion people. So these are the facts that made me go vegan, and that is why I see animal exploitation as a geopolitical issue. This is our one little planet, so why are we using it like that?
That's really interesting, because that's a very similar reason why I went vegan. You've just elucidated that whole geopolitical, human rights, animal rights, all intertwined into one very succinct kind of explanation. And I am fascinated by this topic, as you know. Yeah. So I'm glad to be listening in on this fascinating story today. So please go on.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be doing this one with you, Meg, because I know you're also like a bit of a history nerd. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I've recently developed a bit of a personal vendetta against the Australian wool industry. And part of the reason for this is because I've been getting a lot of targeted ads for clothing made from Australian merino. And these ads are always very greenwashed, coming from companies marketing themselves as ethical, natural, and sustainable. I did walk past a shop in the real world once, and I saw there was a sign on the front that said, "Join the sheepskin revolution." And it had a picture of like two flags, but the flags were sheepskins. Like, I don't know how that would work. And on the window of the shop, there was this text that said, "We're on a mission to remove synthetic materials from the home and replace them with a sustainable natural fiber that has been tried and tested over the last 100,000 years. We could tell you all the sciencey reasons that it's called the miracle fiber, but what we really care about is how the primal comfort of sheepskin will change your life. Come inside and see for yourself." Yeah, so I'm going to call ram shit on the 100,000. Because sheep were only domesticated about 10,000 years ago, so I actually think it might be a typo on the shop window. But more importantly, wool and sheepskin are not sustainable. They require a lot of land, which must be deforested, which means displacing Indigenous peoples and wildlife. Sheep also emit a lot of methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself. We will get into all that. The point is, I see this marketing everywhere and it's false and misleading. However, I will concede that products made from genuine wool are usually not fast fashion, especially if it's a pure wool product, because wool is very durable and it's more expensive than polyester, of course. My argument is that wool isn't a good alternative to fast fashion. I think we need to head in the direction of high quality, durable products made from things like organic cotton, hemp, flax, and synthetic materials when appropriate, although, you know, the clothing industry is currently overusing polyester, which has some pretty environmentally disastrous results. So I decided a while ago I wanted to talk about the Australian wool industry on Freedom of Species, but as with many subjects that I've covered on this show, this went a lot broader than I expected, because this isn't just about Australian wool. It's also about the expansion of the largest empire in history, the British Empire, alongside the rise of industrial capitalism, you know, that sort of thing. So because this story is quite detailed and quite epic, I don't want to just do rapid info dumping. So I've decided that I'm just going to cover one century at a time. So today I'm going to cover Britain and Australia in the 1700s. And the circumstances leading up to the creation of the Australian wool industry. This is a story of profit over people, of land control, forced displacement, and animal exploitation. We'll be talking about the early colonization of Australia, but it's important for us to always keep in mind that colonization is not only historical, but it has direct parallels in modern times. The colonization of Australia started in 1788, well, the Israeli occupation of Palestine began 160 years later in 1948. Australia's first 150 years had several violent conflicts between First Nations people and the British colonisers, known as the Australian Frontier Wars. In some cases, this was state-sanctioned violence, and sometimes it was unauthorised but often tolerated settler violence. The last of these wars took place in the 1930s in Australia, but we still live under the legacy of those actions carried out by past governments and settlers, and colonisation takes new forms in modern times. Israel, on the other hand, is still in the early stages of the colonial project, and what the Israeli state and settlers have been doing to people in Gaza and the West Bank is comparable to the actions of Australian governments of the 19th century. It was wrong then, and it's wrong now. I'm sure our listeners are well aware of the genocidal violence that is currently happening in Gaza, carried out by the Israeli state against the Palestinian people. Australia continues to trade with Israel, including supplying them with our Australian-grown wool, which is likely used in military uniforms, just to bring this full circle. On that note, I want to give an update on our friend of the show who lives in Gaza, Anas Arafat, founder of the organization Plant the Land Gaza. Before Israel started relentlessly bombing Gaza in October of 2023, Anas had been working on several food-growing projects with the goal of long-term food sovereignty for the people of Gaza. But since then, the IDF has completely decimated the land and cut off food supply to people in Gaza. Despite this modern-day atrocity happening before our eyes, Anas continues to do his food distribution work, bringing critical relief to people in his community. However, just recently, Anas has been hit with an unimaginable personal tragedy. Now, I'm going to paraphrase this post from our Freedom of Species social media. Our hearts are with our friend Anas Arafat. The Arafat family home in Al-Tufa, Gaza, was bombed by Israel on July 14 and killed many family members. Anas lost his father, his mother, his two brothers, his two sisters-in-law, and seven nieces and nephews. None of them have been retrieved from under the rubble. One of Anas's nieces, Haya, was pulled from the rubble and is now with Anas, his wife, and children. We pay our respects to Anas and the memory of his family. We will remember them. We send our love, condolences, and solidarity to Anas and his family. We will continue to call for a free Palestine and for our government to take immediate and decisive action to sanction Israel. Please follow Anas and support his incredible work. And one of our amazing Freedom of Species hosts, Caroline, is running an Australian-based fundraiser in support of Anas's mutual aid work in Gaza. So you can find that donation link on the Freedom of Species social media pages, and I'll post it in the show notes of the podcast. Donating money for food and water is one very small thing we can do to help people in Gaza, but we also have to continue to pressure our governments to sanction Israel to stop enabling the genocide. So thank you very much to everyone who has supported our fundraisers for Plant the Land so far.
Thank you. And it's a very important reminder that the colonial activities of a previous era are reflected in what's currently happening now. And as you said, it was wrong back then and it's wrong now. And this is a very personal reflection of those activities. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. We're never forgetting the people in Gaza as we go forward.
No.
Now, today I'm going to play some songs from a modern Australian country singer-songwriter and storyteller called Luke O'Shea. He writes a lot of songs about Australian history and connecting with the history of the country you live on. This first song I'll play is about learning the true history of Australia, including learning about First Nations people who resisted colonisation throughout the years. So this is Happy Australia Day by Luke O'Shea.
of Species would like to thank Project Fresh Start for their financial support of this program. Project Fresh Start provides free plant-based food to the community, with a focus on providing healthy, fresh plant-based food and education around healthy eating and living in a way that sustains the individual, the community, the animals, and the planet. To find out more about our community lunches and programs, check out projectfreshstart.org.au.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio. I'm Betty Mallon, and I'm here today with Meg. You just heard Happy Australia Day by Luke O'Shea. Now, in that song, he mentions the name of several Aboriginal freedom fighters from history, and most of these people I hadn't heard of before, but I got to learn about some of them during my reading into early Australian history, so that's pretty cool. I want to say, for those of you listening to the podcast version of the show, you will have noticed that we have to cut out the songs from that version of the show because we're not licensed to re-upload them to the streaming platforms, but there will be links to all the music in the show notes if you would like to check it out.
Excellent. All right, back onto your fascinating story.
Yeah, so today we are talking about the early history of the Australian wool industry. For those people in the audience who remember Australia in the 1980s or earlier, you might recall that we used to have an Australian $2 note. On that note, there was a picture of an Australian merino wool sheep next to the face of the man who was largely credited with founding the Australian wool industry, a controversial man of Scottish ancestry named John MacArthur. So, I'll begin the story of the Australian wool industry with some foreshadowing. We begin in the 1700s in the newly formed Kingdom of Great Britain, which encompassed England, Scotland, and Wales. Now, admittedly, 18th century Scottish history is not my specialty. Maybe you know more about this than me, Meg.
Sorry.
But, you know, I wanted to mention these events because they involve context for some key characters to our story of the Australian wool industry. So this Kingdom of Great Britain thing was a bit of a worry for the other European powers. So France and Sweden sponsored an uprising in 1745 known as the Jacobite Uprising.
Yes.
You've heard of this?
Yes, I have, yep.
Yeah, so vaguely the reasons for this was they wanted this other guy to become King of Great Britain and an army was recruited from the Scottish Highlands. The Highlanders supported this guy because they thought he would give the Scots a better deal. But the uprising was unsuccessful, and any surviving Scots who were involved were forced to flee the country. One of these men was a man named Alexander MacArthur, who would become the father of Australia's first wool baron, our $2 note guy, John MacArthur. The MacArthurs became one of thousands of Scottish Highland families who would be forced to leave their ancestral homeland over the next 100 or so years. After the Jacobite uprising, the Scottish Highlands was thought of a place hard to control and difficult to profit from as Great Britain was entering the industrial age. But profit found a way. Wool had been one of England's most powerful trade goods for several centuries. Just to give you an idea of how important wool was to England, I wanted to quote the opening paragraph of this article entitled Great Wolf Slayers of England by Alan Castellau from historicuk.com. Quote, have you ever wondered where all the money came from to construct those magnificent medieval cathedrals that stand proudly in the centres of the beautiful and historic cities of England, or the money to build the myriad of castellated churches that form the focus of a multitude of fine English villages, towns, and cities? It was indeed the wool trade that funded most of this building, as well as paying for the many medieval wars that England waged during this period. Sheep were indeed the beating heart of the national wealth. And then I'll skip a little bit. Just one small issue hampered the English countryside from being the perfect natural sheep farm, wolves, end quote. The article then goes on to detail how wolves were systematically hunted to eradication in Great Britain by the 1500s, for the benefit of the British wool industry. This is not the main topic for today, but I'll link that article in the show notes if you'd like to know more. So not only was Australia built on the sheep's back, but England was too. In the 1700s, there had been some recent success in breeding wool sheep that were suitable for life in the rugged Scottish Highlands. But there was one problem from the perspective of the aspiring landlords and capitalists. Because you see, wool sheep take up a lot of space, and the Scottish Highlands were at the time infested with, not wolves, but unprofitable subsistence farmers, aka human beings. And so began one of the most brutal chapters in Scottish history, known as the Highland Clearances. Between 1750 and 1860, thousands of Scottish Highlanders were forcefully evicted from their indigenous homeland to make way for wool sheep, who would be further exploited to grow the wealth of the rapidly expanding British Empire. So this was not such a case of England colonizing Scotland, as they had done in Ireland and many other places. Although, let's be clear, the wool industry played a large role in messing up Ireland as well. Like, we can all blame England for a lot of things that have gone wrong in the world, but with the Highland Clearances, it was more that the Scottish clan leaders sold out their own people so they could become wealthy landlords and part of the emerging Scottish aristocracy. So it's more a case of emerging capitalism and class hierarchies rather than colonization. These displaced Highlanders were forced to disperse all over the world. Many went south to the expanding cities of Scotland and England. Some went to mainland Europe, and many more went across the sea to Britain's colonies in Canada, America, or the West Indies, and later to New Zealand and, of course, Australia. If you have ancestors from the Scottish Highlands, as many Australians do, they may have been impacted by this, and it could be why they ended up in Australia. You know, raise a hand if your ancestors were personally victimized by the wool industry. Probably quite a lot of us.
Yeah.
So tragically, some of these displaced Scots would go on to become colonizers themselves, continuing the same cycle of violence against the indigenous peoples of these so-called new worlds as was done to them. And in some cases, it was done for the same reasons, forcefully displacing people to expand the wool industry for the wealth of the British Empire. So let's move on to the story of how that went down right here in the land that would come to be known as Australia. So for the next little part of the show, we're going to follow our $2 note guy, Australia's first wool baron, John MacArthur, a messy historical figure and renowned drama king. John MacArthur was born in Plymouth, England in 1767, and he joined the British Army at age 15. And this was not uncommon for boys of the time period, with some even joining as young as 10 or 11. And I guess that's why all these colonizers are such calm, well-rounded guys. Well, they started nice and young in the military.
The trauma is starting young.
Yeah. So as John's father had previously been displaced from Argyllshire, Scotland, his family had little status and wealth in English society. But John had only one thing on his mind: social mobility. Just for himself, by the way, like not for everyone. Like, let's not go crazy. In 1788, which is the same year the first fleet landed in Sydney Cove, but it's also the year that John met Elizabeth Veal, the woman who would become his wife. Elizabeth's family, slightly wealthier than John's, did not initially approve of John as a suitor, describing him as, quote, too proud and haughty for our humble fortune. Elizabeth is an interesting historical figure in her own right, being the subject of multiple fiction and non-fiction books. We can't know for sure how Elizabeth felt about John at this point, but what we do know is that English women in this time period had few choices about their lives. Elizabeth was pregnant before the marriage, and this may have been the reason she had to marry him. The newlyweds were promptly relocated, so the date of the baby's birth would not arouse suspicion in the community. The first baby was born, and Elizabeth soon became pregnant with the second. Meanwhile, John is still scheming to advance his social status, but social mobility in 1700s England was almost impossible for the son of a tradie. However, John saw a chance at aristocracy outside of England, and he accepted a role as lieutenant in the new British colony of New South Wales, which would mean relocating his new wife and child. The timing of Elizabeth's pregnancy meant that their second child would be born during the voyage, but I guess John didn't care about that. John and Elizabeth were set to travel to New South Wales on a ship that was part of the Second Fleet. But before the ships even left England, John decided to challenge the first master of the ship to a pistol duel. And this is going to become a pattern of behaviour for John going forward.
Mm.
He's not a chill guy. So the reason for the duel is because John was not happy with his family cabin being placed next to where the female convicts were held. Transport of the Second Fleet to Australia was outsourced to a private company, which was involved in the transatlantic slave trade. So these were slave transport ships, and the conditions were considered even more brutal for the convicts of the Second Fleet than they were on the First Fleet. So for reference, 25% of the male convicts on the Second Fleet died during transport in comparison to just 2.8% on the First Fleet. So we've got like 10 times as many more dead. And there was public outcry about this. And the ship got nicknamed the Death Fleet because so many people died and were treated very poorly. John wasn't concerned about the welfare of the convicts, though. He just found them smelly and he didn't want to be near them. Another casualty of the Second Fleet was Elizabeth's second baby, who was born in winter as the ship sailed through the Southern Ocean and lived only an hour. In June of 1790, the Second Fleet arrived on the lands of the Eora people, or so-called Port Jackson, which was a rough colonial prison settlement on the brink of starvation, whose extremely limited resources were put under further strain by the arrival of a fleet of extremely sick and hungry convicts. Sheep first arrived in New South Wales on the First Fleet, but these sheep were only for mutton because survival rather than enterprise was the only goal of the colony in these early stages. They also brought some cows, but most of them escaped almost immediately and were not found for, I think, a few decades later, perhaps.
Oh.
So I really can't overstate how absolutely bad life was in the early days of the colony of New South Wales. Capital punishments like floggings were commonplace. There had not been enough food to last for the first 2 years, and the first attempts at growing introduced cereal crops had been unsuccessful. Convicts, marines, and officers alike were placed on increasingly reduced food rations, which obviously reduced their capacity to farm and build things. People also didn't have proper clothing to wear. Not all marines had shoes, and some of the convicts ended up working naked so they didn't wear out their tattered clothes to preserve the clothes they have. So while many would see nothing but desperation, John MacArthur saw an opportunity. With his aristocrat ambitions, he wasted no time and began scheming to advance his position in the colony. He seemed to be able to strike a balance between charming the right people to get what he wanted, while at the same time causing so many feuds and dramas. MacArthur realized the well people in the colony were hungry and desperate for any supplies that would bring some form of comfort. There was profit to be made and power to be gained if he was the one who controlled the supplies coming in. So let's find out what he does next after the break. Leave it on a cliffhanger.
So what's the story that song that we're going to be listening to now?
Yeah. So the next song, it's sort of a song, again, about learning about Australian history. And this is called Sing Me a Story by Luke O'Shea.
I'm there in the ochre, scratched deep in the wall.
You sing me a story, sing it for me.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science, and scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au. That's animalfreesci.org.au.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio. I'm Betty Mallon, and I'm here in the studio with Meg. You just heard Sing Me a Story by Luke O'Shea. So today we are talking about the founding of the Australian wool industry, and we are currently following Australia's first wool baron, John MacArthur. So at this point, I feel like I should mention that for a long time, John MacArthur was viewed as a kind of Australian hero.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, which I guess that's kind of like why he was on our $2 note. It fits very well into this like great man of history myth. But more recent historians have viewed him as a more controversial figure, and we're about to find out why. So I'll give a brief overview of MacArthur's schemes and conflicts as he tried to rise to the top of colonial Sydney society. So in early Australia, the history of the colony, the leader of the colony was the governor, and most of the European inhabitants were either in the military or they were convicts. So you can imagine that there was a lot of opportunity for corruption, depending on who was in charge. Under the first governor, Arthur Phillip, convicts, soldiers, and officers were given equal food rations, and the sale of alcoholic spirits was strictly limited. However, under the next acting governor, Major Francis Gross, only convict rations were reduced, and certain officers of the New South Wales Corps started to become rather wealthy from the sale of alcoholic rum. Major Gross promoted MacArthur to paymaster and inspector of public works, which gave him significant power and influence in the settlement. Generous land grants and free convict labour was also given out to MacArthur and other officers of the New South Wales Corps during the Gross administration. This led to the formation of a military oligarchy and a trade cartel, from which these officers of the New South Wales Corps made significant profits. So much rum was being traded at significant markups that it actually became a form of currency in Sydney, and the New South Wales Corps became known as the Rum Corps. The Rum Corps also controlled the courts and the legal systems, so they could intimidate anyone who tried to interfere with their racketeering. So all these dodgy systems, which MacArthur greatly benefited from, emerged under acting Governor Gross, who was in charge for just 2 years. In 1795, Governor Hunter took over the position and tried to reform the colony by attempting to separate civil and military control. This forced MacArthur to resign as Inspector of Public Works, and he was not happy about this loss of power. So he immediately started scheming to undermine Governor Hunter. He wrote letters to England blaming Hunter for the widespread drunkenness in Sydney, even though MacArthur himself was more responsible for that situation. The Rum Corps had too much power, and ultimately Hunter failed to reform the colony and was dismissed in 1799. One governor down and the Rum Corps is still in control. They're kind of like colonial gangsters, intimidating.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah. So they're intimidating, threatening, and even assaulting anyone who wanted reform. During these years, MacArthur used his connections and control of trade to obtain his first merino sheep. Merinos were an extremely valuable breed of Spanish fine-haired wool sheep, which had only recently become available for export from Spain. The next challenger who stepped up was Governor Philip Gidley King, who quickly faced the scorn of John MacArthur after attempting to prevent his officers of the New South Wales Corps from trading in rum. MacArthur rallied the Rum Corps to boycott Governor King. However, his superior, Colonel William Patterson, refused to cooperate. The officers agree to sit down in a meeting to discuss how they can proceed. Actually, I'm just kidding. They have another pistol duel.
I'm seeing a pattern here.
Yeah. So I don't really know how these pistol duels worked at the time. I believe they were technically illegal but tolerated. My vague understanding is that the main goal wasn't to kill your enemy, because that would be murder, but it was to show that you were willing to die for your honour if someone insulted you. So if you call some hothead Englishman a scoundrel or a rascal, like, you better get ready to duel, that's all I can say. So Patterson gets shot in the shoulder during the duel with MacArthur, and he doesn't die, but he's severely injured and rightfully pissed. So So at this point, Governor King is sick of his shit. So he places MacArthur under house arrest. And knowing he won't face any consequences in the Sydney courts dominated by the Rum Corps, he sends him back to England to face a court-martial, along with extensive documents describing how MacArthur had amassed a great fortune through monopolization and extortion. However, somehow, despite being heavily guarded, these documents mysteriously went missing during the journey back to England. The English legal authorities dropped the charges due to lack of evidence and advised that MacArthur's court-martial should have been in Sydney. During the voyage to England, MacArthur makes friends with this guy who is high up in the British East India Company, and he uses this man's connections in London to advance his business ventures. He quits his position in the army and he lobbies in London for support of his wool production in New South Wales. Britain is struggling with their wool supply at this time because they are in a lot of wars and domestic supply is no longer going to cut it. So MacArthur puts himself forward as the guy who can grow wool for the empire. He gains the backing of Colonial Secretary Lord Camden for another 10,000-acre land grant and purchase of 10 purebred merino sheep from the royal flock. He also purchases his own ship, in which he has a golden fleece figurehead installed on the front, which I'm guessing is like a big golden ram on the front of the ship. So, you know, he's just flexing now.
Yeah, that's an ancient Greek reference, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just... Honestly, this part's kind of iconic. Like, he gets sent there under arrest, but then he comes back 4 years later with his own ship, with this giant golden ram on the front, with another large land grant, some prize wool sheep, and no consequences for his action. Governor King tries to prevent MacArthur from getting further land, stating, quote, "One half of the colony already belongs to him, and it will not be long before he gets the other half," end quote. However, the Colonial Office in London replied to King and affirmed MacArthur's right to the land. Now, Governor King is pretty worn down at this point from all the antagonism from MacArthur and the Rum Corps, so he steps down in 1806 and returned to England, where he dies just 2 years later from poor health. MacArthur names the new land he was granted Camden Park after his patron, Lord Camden. It seems like John MacArthur is almost untouchable at this point, and he's on his way to becoming one of the wealthiest men in the colony. He's already had some pretty dramatic feuds with governors and other officers, but he's just about to face his most serious feud with the new governor, William Bligh. Have you ever heard of this guy?
I have.
Have you ever seen, like, Mutiny on the Bounty?
I have not.
Oh, no. Okay. I haven't seen it either, but the story of Mutiny on the Bounty is pretty fun. Probably don't have time to tell the story now, but William Bligh is also a very messy historical figure, and he's fun to talk about, but I'm going to leave it there. We're talking about the colonial offices of early Australia for now, because I want to talk a little about what was happening with the people of the Eora Nation who were already living around the Port Jackson settlement before these guys got here. The settlement was very weak in the early days, so the Eora people probably could have overwhelmed and killed the whole settlement if they wanted to, but they chose not to. They wanted to take a more diplomatic approach. Sadly, smallpox and other diseases killed around 50% of Aboriginal people in the Sydney area within the first 2 years of settlement. There was some early attempts at diplomacy with Governor Arthur Phillip, but this was pretty short-lived. In this early period, there aren't really any full-scale wars happening with First Nations people before 1800, but there were plenty of persistent, organized resistance and guerrilla-style warfare. This took the form of raids, crop burnings, and small-scale fighting. As the Europeans were clearing land, they were, of course, destroying the native food sources. So, of course, Aboriginal people wanted to stop that expansion. I wanted to specifically mention one Bidjigal man named Pemulwuy, who led a lot of resistance in the early days. This is one of the people that gets mentioned in that Happy Australia Day song. Pemulwuy had been shot a few times without dying, and he was even captured once, but he managed to escape. And this actually led him to believe that the Europeans couldn't kill him. And this gave him great bravery in putting up resistance until his death in 1802. So Pemulwuy is remembered as a legend to this day, as a resistance fighter. So yeah, that's most of the what I had prepared for today.
Yeah, so setting the scene for that, you know, that wool industry, and I guess we kind of need to know this background, because, and also it's really important because this background sets us up for industry in Australia, including animal industry. And as you say, you know, the Australian economy was riding on the sheep's back, as they used to say. And that's how, you know, that's how we kind of made ourselves as an economy here in Australia. You know, it was those kind of natural resources, in inverted commas. So that this has been fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I'm really waiting for, I'm sure there's going to be a part two, because we haven't even got to wool and the wars.
The wool industry hasn't really started yet. It's, we're just on the edge background. Of it starting. But I think it's worth mentioning the wool industry hadn't started, but John MacArthur was already rich from a legal trade in like rum and stuff like that.
So we're setting up, so really what you're doing here is setting up the background and showing the character that started the wool industry here in Australia, what sort of person he was, and how that would have translated into his sort of his treatment of sheep, his furthering of the wool industry, his opportunistic, you know, machinations of how he can get wool and how he can further his wealth and his standing in society and stuff. So this is the man that started basically the wool industry in Australia, and this is the kind of character that he is. And I think it's really important to show that, because he was actually, MacArthur was quite a, I know in history, when I was doing Australian history, we learned about him essentially because he is the father of wool, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this like sort of legendary story that we have about him, I feel like that was the story he wanted sort of painted about of himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think his children, I think there was like 7 MacArthur children with Elizabeth and John. I think they saw his legacy as being an important thing as well. So they would have also.
Because it's a family legacy, isn't it? I mean, definitely. It's not just his legacy, it's the MacArthur family legacy. So of course, that whole rum trading and the corruption and the hot-headed pistol duel nature, that sort of stuff is not particularly wanting to be, you know, they don't want that have you know, in the public record. They don't want that to be the way that they, you know, people see their dad. So,
Yeah, it's interesting because John really also, I guess, dragged the reputation of all these other governors through the mud. And for years, these guys had to sort of try to get their reputation back because John had told so many lies about them. But yeah, and he got remembered positively for a long time until maybe more recently when historians looked more into it.
As I say, history is written by the winners. But when you go back and have a look at the public records, you can kind of get a bit more of the fuller story. And that's kind of the case in a lot of different, you know, historical records. And you were talking about medieval churches and stuff. I had no idea because that's my era. That's my jam.
Yeah.
I didn't know that medieval churches were funded on the backs of the wool industry from England and all of that sort of trade and mercantile industry. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sort of like, I feel like I'm kind of a wool truther now. I'm like, it's all about the wool industry. Everything comes back to the wool industry.
Well, I was thinking we probably should wrap up now. Yeah. Is there anything you want to say before? And, you know, should we expect a number two soon, or is there lots of research to do?
I think we can expect a number two fairly soon. Ooh. I won't say exactly when, but hopefully in the next few weeks.
Fantastic.
So this last song we're going to play, this is a song about remembering the Dharawal people. And this is an Aboriginal group of people that lived around the area that's now known as the MacArthur region, which probably tells you all you need to know. But yeah, it's just about remembering them and what was lost, and that we still live on someone's country and we need to respect that. So this is Dharawal by Jade Kennedy and Luke O'Shea.
Yulanga, Yulanga, Yulanga Labu.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.